it had to do with the discussion that I was here before. And it's about what is going on in U of T about the difference between the religious department and TSD. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that really based on a theory, or that's just like a political perception of
Oh, no, that's based in a definite position on religious studies and theology and the difference between the two. We will see. One of the things that we're going to be reading in the course of the semester is Lonergan's three lectures on religious studies and theology, where he's making some suggestions there, too, about how they could be brought together. But religious studies, which is the Department of Religion at the University of Toronto, is distinct from the Toronto School of Theology. For them, religious studies is... Well, and to put it in functional specialty language, it's research, interpretation, and history, and nothing else. So you can do those things whether you have a faith commitment or not. You know, I mean, if you're a good researcher, a good archaeologist, and with no religious commitment, you can be just as good an archaeologist as Albright, for instance, who had a religious commitment, you know. And at least with your methods aren't going to be any different. Religion isn't going to influence your method in archaeology. It's not going to make any difference in it at all. If it does, it's probably going to influence it for the worse, you know. Well, we can't dig that up because it's, But, and your method of interpretation is not going to differ. The results will differ because you're a different person. But your method is going to be, you know, I mean, whether it's historical critical method or whatever, it doesn't make any difference as far as employing the method is concerned, whether you believe or don't believe. And same with historical critical history, doing critical history. The results will differ. Because you will see some things, for instance, you know, you will be open to the possibility of certain explanations of certain data that you wouldn't be open to if, but you may also be open to superstitious interpretations as well, you know, because there's always that danger for the believer. There was a great article on the Shroud of Turin in the paper this morning, and it still is up for grabs what that is, you know. And there are some people who reject out of hand that this would be the cloth that covered Christ and we have this image because of the resurrection, they would reject that out of hand because, well, that's impossible, you see. But if you are a believer, that's not impossible. It doesn't mean that that's what it is. But that is a possible interpretation. That the resurrection was this transformation of matter into energy that left a negative, a photographic negative on this cloth, and that this is what is there. That is not impossible. But there are also believers who believe in the resurrection who don't think this is a genuine thing, you know, or don't think this is Jesus. So it doesn't mean that you're definitely committing yourself, but you are open to a possible interpretation that you wouldn't be open to otherwise. But I thought that I was surprised to see that the debate is raging as much as it always was over that this morning. You know. But one of the things that was brought out in the article fairly well is, well, if you do believe in the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, that is one possible explanation of how we got this piece of cloth. But that's, you can't go any further than that. It's not a proof of the resurrection. It's not... doesn't mean that it is Jesus, you know. But that's the kind of thing where the method of study might be the same, but the results will be different because you will be open to different possibilities. You know. Lonergan uses the example of miracles. You may use the same method, but if you're open to the possibility of miracles, you will probably give a different interpretation of some extraordinary events, then, or you certainly will be open to an interpretation of some extraordinary events that other people would not be open to. So, how did I get into all of that? Religious studies and theology. Yeah. So, the Department of Religion at the University of Toronto is typical of most departments of religious studies as contrasted with theology, that it is not here to develop or explore or anything like that one tradition. There's no commitment in the department. Okay, whereas the Toronto School of Theology is made up of seven schools, all of which have a commitment to a given religious tradition. And so now, today, it's interesting, and I think this is a difference from previous generations, that I think that the theologians are much more open to religious studies than might be the other way around. You know, that religious studies they want to put off anything to do with theology. You know, whereas I think theologians realize they need religious studies. You know, they need serious research, interpretation, history, and so on and so forth. But there's one way of speaking about the difference between the two is that religious studies will go no further than those first three functional specialties. Research, interpretation, and history. It doesn't get into the question of who's right and who's wrong, of the truth of a tradition, the authenticity of a given tradition or anything like that. It's not an issue for it. So Wilfred Cantwell Smith, Notterman quotes him in these lectures. Smith raised the question in one of his lectures at the University of Toronto, that religious studies has uncovered vast amounts of data and so on that's extraordinarily valuable, but they have not answered the question of what makes for religious commitment. Why is anybody doing this in the first place, being religious? And it's theology that answers that. Okay. Now, we've looked at, I think, all of the stuff on the rest of this first lecture on page 3, I think we've already covered. And let's start with number 9 at the bottom of page 3, the second lecture, the functional specialty systematic. A first question that arises is how the Christian religion ever allowed itself to be involved in systematic thinking. And Lonergan's first response is gradually. That's how it allowed itself. It took a long time. And in section 2 of the paper, he outlines successive stages in that process. And we might think of these. I'm thinking here of Fred Crowe's book, The Theology of the Christian Word. Fred will speak of these stages as transitions in the church's preservation of the Word of God. And one of those transitions, if we skip down to number 14 on page 4, is in the Middle Ages, with the transition to the systematic preservation of the Word of God, which is basically what Aquinas was doing when he wrote the Summa Theologiae. But it was a systematic preservation of the Word of God entrusted to the Church. So it was using system to do that. I think what we should do then is just to start with number 14 on page 4. Theology did not seriously aspire to be systematic until the Middle Ages. That aspiration arose out of the inner exigences of the situation. For instance, and I don't go into all of the details on this, but in Grace and Freedom, Lonergan, the first volume in the collected works, Lonergan begins by tracing how, until Aquinas moved to system, there were questions with regard to the relationship between grace and freedom that simply couldn't be answered. I should have prepared this part a little bit better because I don't have it quite at my fingertips. But he shows, I guess I'll just have to say generically, he shows some inconsistencies in the tradition prior to, there were questions that couldn't be answered until the systematic formulations became a possibility. So what you see, if you read the Summa, for instance, the Summa Theologiae, you see the question, asking questions, becomes a technique for reconciling differing authorities in matters of faith and apparent oppositions between faith and reason. So the question asks whether such and such is so. And then, first of all, well, it seems that the answer is no. And Aquinas lines up the authorities who would say no. And then he has the said contra. But on the other hand, Augustine says, or Dionysius says, or Aristotle says, so you get differing authorities. And then he comes in and says, now here's what I do. So he starts out by giving you the differing authorities. Okay? And then his own answer is an attempt to reconcile those differing authorities, or to reconcile apparent inconsistencies between faith and reason. So that technique is applied in larger and smaller scales, and the Summa is an example, the Summa Theologiae is a clear example of it, on a very large scale, using that technique. He does this throughout the whole thing. It's every question is like that. It first starts out with a question, the naysayers, the yes-sayers, and then his own answer. And then he answers the objections at the end. And then he goes on to the next question. He goes on through three huge volumes like that.
Is there a name for that technique?
Disputatio, the disputation, the medieval disputation. So the larger the scale of the operations, the graver became a fresh problem, and the fresh problem is this. And this is what really gave rise to the system, bringing system into all of this. How was one to make sure that the many principles of solution that were proposed were themselves free from contradiction? Well, the one obvious solution was to derive one's principles of solution from some system. If the system was coherent, the solutions would also be coherent. If the system lacked coherence, this lack would be magnified in the solutions, and this magnification would lead to a correction of the system. One simple way to move to systematic differentiation is to adopt and perhaps also adapt a system that already exists, and that's what medieval theologians, and especially most successfully Thomas, did with Aristotle. So it's at this point that you have the beginnings of what I'm calling now in my own work a unified field structure for systematic theology. You have a set. In Thomas, you have definitely general categories and special categories. And his general categories are taken from Aristotle's philosophy, and his special categories are released by the discovery of the theorem of the supernatural, which happened in the beginning, the early part of the 13th century, where this theorem of that there's an entitatively distinct order of reality that consists of God's grace that is related to nature but different from nature. And then you've got the basis for doing a systematic theology. You have the basis for the special categories in what they called the supernatural, which doesn't mean what we mean today by, you know, these movies of spooks and that sort of thing. But rather, it means what is beyond the reach of nature. Okay? So reaching God is beyond the reach of nature. Reaching God as God is in God's own self can be done only by God giving God to us. It can't be by us reaching God. So it comes to us as gift. It's not something that we can do on our own. So you have that for the special categories and the Aristotle's philosophy for the general categories, and then you start mixing them up with the different questions. You bring them in and you use them as they're helpful to solve the problems. Today, I'm suggesting that the Lonergan differentiated the theorem of the supernatural into those four relations that he speaks about in De Deo Trino, so that's your source of the general categories. And the special categories won't be Aristotle's philosophy, but it will be derived from, I'm suggesting, Lonergan's cognitional theory, epistemology, metaphysics, and ethics. And especially in terms of a theory of history that comes out of that. And that's our But that's all an evolution from Aquinas. Aquinas was the one who brought general and system and special categories together in the first place. And now, today, the special categories are a development of the ones that he used, and the general categories are a development of the ones that he used. Anyway, that's going into other stuff. Still, Lonergan says, towards the end of the page, one cannot move from common sense to systematic thinking without creating a crisis. Why? One is introducing a new technical language, a new mode of formulating one's convictions and beliefs, a new mode of intellectual development, a new mode of verification. Automatically, this formed a new social group. In those days, they were known as the Dominicans, okay? A new social group that understands the new technical language, that is expert in transposing from prior to later modes of expression, that is raising new questions and solving them in a new way. And automatically, there also is formed a far larger group, in those days led by the Franciscans, that greets the new movement with incomprehension. There begins the social problem caused by differentiations of consciousness. In the medieval context, it took the form of the Dominican-Franciscan conflict, where he's got a quote in De Deo Trino, a quote from the Bishop of Canterbury, John Peckham, who thought that all the Dominican theologians were influenced by the devil because they weren't satisfied that Augustine was enough. And, they weren't satisfied because Augustine didn't answer all the questions. And in order to answer some of these questions, you had to appeal to a philosophical mode of thinking. That Augustine certainly was not foreign to Augustine, but he wasn't a systematic thinker. So, as Lonergan says, the common sense viewpoint simply didn't know what was going on. They interpreted this movement to system as a denial of the faith, and it was anything but that. It was an attempt to understand the faith. Aquinas did not set Augustine aside or belittle him. He revered him, and his later works are more fully and accurately Augustinian than his earlier ones. Again, Aquinas did not derive his religious doctrine from Aristotle, but this is what he was accused of doing. He derived his religious doctrine from the Christian tradition, but he used Aristotle partly as a master and partly as a quarry, a source, to construct a systematic presentation of Christian doctrine. Okay, so then he goes on through the rest of the history, and I don't know that we need to do too much there. Well, I guess maybe we do, because it's how these things became separated. So in Aquinas, you've got the two working together. Right, within his own context. We can't do it exactly the same way that he did it, but they had the philosophy and the theology working together. Symbiosis. Problems with Aristotle, which he outlines on pages 186 and 87, led to subsequent problems in theology. Scotus and Ockham accepted Aristotle's logical works, which were the least important to Aquinas. The important things for Aquinas were Aristotle's metaphysics, his De Anima, his physics, I think those three, those were the big ones. But the later Scotus and Ockham accepted the logical works but regarded the other writings as merely pagan. Scholasticism became decadent because the only thing that took over from Aristotle was logic, and Aristotle's logic left a lot to be desired. It was too rigid, and it was too uniform and almost kind of mechanistic in its applications, the syllogism and so on and so forth. So scholasticism became decadent with Scotus, and Lonergan's not the only relatively contemporary theologian who says that. It's also very much more, even much more sharp in von Balthasar in two of his volumes in the Aesthetics. In his Aesthetics, he has severe criticism of Duns Scotus. But that was where both of them then coming. Von Balthasar and Lonergan are very different thinkers, but they both find the origins of the Catholic theology becoming really irrelevant, they both would trace that back to Scotus. And so on. Okay, so then there's the Reformation, and then what came up in its wake, what came in the wake of the Reformation was Melchior Cano, as a Catholic, with his De Locis Theologicis. Return to the sources, okay, no problem with that. But what theology really consists in is a set of medieval doctrines to be proved by appeal to scriptural and patristic writings, to the councils and the consensus of theologians. Aquinas isn't proving anything. Aquinas is trying to understand what he already believes. It's very different. It's not proof. But now Catholic theology becomes a matter of proof. You prove it. So this, as he says, seeking to transform the ancient fides querens intellectum, faith seeking understanding, which is what Aquinas is doing, into an argument that, you know, if you were brought up in this tradition, you knew these arguments don't prove anything. Okay, but still, they were trying to find a proof. And that became dominant, and it was right down until after the Second Vatican Council that it was that kind of approach to theology was dominant. This was the beginning of dogmatic theology, as opposed to doctrinal and systematic theology, the language that Lonergan will use, but dogmatic theology. Okay? Dogmatic not only in the sense of being a study of dogma, but being dogmatic. You know, and Lonergan places the date where theology definitively started to fall behind the times precisely with this development, because he says it was about 100 years after Cano when they sort of formalized his system. Well, he died in 1560, and Lonergan sets 1680 as the date when theology lost it completely and just fell into complete irrelevance to what was going on in the world. Then you have the modern period where you've got changes in the notion of science, philosophy, hermeneutics, and history, all of which Catholic theology, at least, was totally lost about how do you keep up with this stuff. And so you had 2 centuries of no crossover, no dialogue, no mutual self-mediation between culture and religion. So what Lonergan's saying then is it's only on the basis of a full understanding and a complete acceptance of the developments in the contemporary notions of science, philosophy, and scholarship that my account of the functional specialty systematics can be understood. Similarly, it's only on the basis of a full acceptance of the developments in contemporary notions of science, philosophy, and scholarship that there can be understood, let alone accepted, my proposal that philosophy of God be taught by theologians in a department of theology, a task that used to belong to theologians and Aquinas, one that somehow they lost but should reclaim. We could read all of 190 and 191 on this, but I think we've probably covered most of the stuff that's in there. So I'm going to stop there and see what questions we have.
Okay. Regarding this, changes in the notion of science impacted what systematics would be. Is he speaking there of both the human sciences and the natural sciences?
He's probably talking mainly about the natural sciences. And the changes there were gradual, too, you know, because, with Newton, for instance, you still have in Newton the assumption that when he reaches what he's going to reach with all of his different experiments and the construction of the theories and so on, it will be universal and necessary. And that comes over into Kant, because when Kant's critique of pure reason, he's talking about Newtonian science. And Kant's saying that Kant is still thinking of science as giving us what is universal and what is necessary. And it's only over the course of these past 2 centuries that science itself came to see that it is not necessary. It's contingent, right? What it arrives at. It doesn't have to be what it arrives at. These laws are not what have to be. It's de facto what is. And that's very different. So there's even a development there. Now, what one of the impacts that this has on theology is that we can also say that systematic theology does not have to be necessary and permanent for all time. Systematic theology is hypothetical. It's the best possible explanation of what we hold to be true. Now, it's true that it's not just the best possible explanation of data, which is what science is. The best explanation up to this point of data, whereas in theology it goes a little bit more than that, because systematics is an attempt to give an explanation of what we already hold is true. The existence of a triune God, the incarnation of the Word, the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, and so on, these extraordinary things, but we hold those to be true and we're trying to understand them. But the attempts to understand remain hypothetical. And they can be improved upon if inconsistencies arise in a given hypothetical framework, then you can scrap the hypothesis. And you can scrap the hypothesis without scrapping the doctrine. You can say, well, yeah, I still hold that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, but that explanation of it doesn't work. So we've come to accept that what systematics is doing is hypothetical.
So it's both science's openness to revision,
yeah,
and the epistemic implications of indeterminism and statistical probability.
Those would be part of it as well. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, for instance, today, certainly, if you're going to present something that I probably will never be able to do because I don't know science well enough, physical science, but a theology of creation is going to have to be done by somebody who also knows physics and chemistry. And who knows quantum theory and indeterminacy and all of this kind of stuff. You can't, you're not talking about it. Otherwise, I mean, you can creation as that there could not be a contingent universe without a creating God. Okay, I mean, I can say that. That's in chapter 19 of Insight. You know, I mean, if being is intelligible, then the contingency of the universe does not make sense unless there is a God who created it. But to understand that creation on the level of our time, I think you would have to know a lot more about atoms and molecules and what the Big Bang might have been and all of that than I am capable of speaking about. My knowledge of the Big Bang is post-systematic. It's not systematic. You know, it's... I don't have any inside systematic theoretical understanding of what that would be at all. Nothing. Like, does that make sense? Craig, were you looking for something there? Maybe I lost it. Okay, anybody? Is that okay? So, my proposal to unify philosophy of God and the functional special systematics is not compatible with what everyone used to hold about textual criticism, exegesis, history, fundamental theology, philosophy, and theological reason. My proposal is compatible with quite different views, and it's only the latter compatibility that I can defend. Now, what I do in the notes here is to take up the questions that followed both the first and the second lectures, especially those having to do with the universality of the gift of God's love. I think that we've already spoken to that in here. So I think, unless you want to bring up some more on that, we can go down to the number 21, the third lecture, the relationship between philosophy of God and the functional specialist systematics. Is that okay? To move to that. So the basic issue is whether, this is at the bottom of page 6, is whether we're going to work from the viewpoint of a deductivist logic or from a moving viewpoint. On the first option, deductivist logic, philosophy of God and systematics cannot form one and the same deductivist system. They cannot, because they start with opposed, contradictory premises. One starts from premises derived from revealed religion and belief and faith, and the other does not. But in a moving or dynamic viewpoint, that isn't the issue, because you're not trying to put together a deductivist system where everything follows from the first set of premises. The first set of premises in a fully logically deductive system, the first set of premises has to contain implicitly everything that's going to follow. And if it doesn't, then you got to go back and you've got to come up with a new set of premises that will contain all of that. So that's the way the static conceptualist kind of theology that he's reacting against was. It took that as a kind of model, even though it could never quite do it all, pull it all off. But that was its ideal. But if rather you're thinking of theology as itself the product of a moving viewpoint, there's a different solution. And that solution is proposed on page 200, and that's in line 6 on page 7 here. The philosophy of God and the functional specialty systematics may have something in common in their origin, where they come from, and in their goal, where they're heading. Each may go its separate way, and yet at the same time, each may borrow from the other and reinforce the other. While their procedures differ, this does not imply that they must be kept in different departments, treated by different professors, expounded in different books, and so on. While they cannot have the unity of a single deductivist process, they may have the unity of a single collaborative process. So the basic issue is between logic and method. A methodical view recognizes to the fullest extent the value of the clarity, coherence, and rigor that logic brings about. But it does not consider logic's achievements to be permanent. On the contrary, it considers logic's achievement to be recurrent. So logic, at a certain point, it puts things in order. But then new questions arise. And then it will come along, once those questions are answered, it will come along and put things in order. And on we move. Human knowledge can be constantly advancing, and the function of logic is to hasten that advance by revealing clearly, coherently, and rigorously the deficiencies of current achievement. It is method that shows the way from the logically clear, coherent, and rigorous position of today to the quite different but logically clear, coherent, and rigorous position of tomorrow. And what does he mean by method there? Be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. So it's that, the raising and answering of questions tutored by this cognitional theory. That's what moves you on from one formulation and one system to another. I think I've mentioned before, maybe not in this class yet, but in De Intellectu et Methodo, lectures that he gave in 1959, where he's really wrestling with the logical ideal. And he has this formulation that at a certain point in theology, the summation, you know, the sign for summation in mathematics, the summation of the answers equals the summation of the questions. And that's when you've got a system that's making sense to everybody, everybody's satisfied with it. But that never stays. A question will arise that can't be answered within the framework of the present summation of the answers. And then at that point, that unity breaks down, only to give rise, after these new questions have been followed through on, to a new place where, for a while, there'll be summation of the questions equals the summation of the answers. But it's never permanent. So in this, he's got the wonderful phrase, the logician is like the mortician, achieving a steady state only temporarily. Before the corpse disintegrates, you know. So, so that's the thing here. The conclusion, I advocate the unity of the functional specialty systematics and the philosophy of God, not on any and every set of assumptions, but only on one precise meaning of unity, and only on certain assumptions concerning the meaning of objectivity, the content of the basic disciplines, the relationship between the basic and other disciplines, the nature of system, and the concept of theology. Now, I want to take these relevant assumptions with regard to each of these points, because they will be important for understanding not only Lonergan, but, well, for understanding other things that we're going to be reading, and for following his development through this period. So the unity, then. What will the unity be of theology, or, well, theology? It will not be the static deductivist unity where everything's already implicitly present in the premises, but the unity of a common origin and a common goal. The common origin, he will say, is religious experience, and he'll talk about the common goal as the development of the person. Now, this doesn't mean, when you're doing systematics, I just finished an article called The Starting Point of Systematic Theology. So it doesn't mean that you don't have a starting point, but I am quite clear in what I wrote that it is not the case that everything's already implicitly present in the starting point. It's just that I'm suggesting that we might want to think about this, what I said before about the unified field structure of the four divine relations and the created participations in those relations that Lonergan speaks about in relationship to the rest of the structure of history as a starting point. But I'm not saying that the whole of the theology of Christ or the church or other religions or anything like that is implicitly included in that. I'm saying rather that this seems to me to formulate the present doctrinal theological context with a certain amount of thoroughness that enables us to get started. But that's very different from saying these premises contain everything that we're going to be talking about. They don't. So unity, then, of a common origin and a common goal. Objectivity. Objectivity is not the fruit of immediate experience plus self-evident and self-evident truths and rigorous inferences. Objectivity is the fruit of authentic subjectivity. Method. Be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. If you are all those things, you will be objective. The basic discipline. Here he states the basic discipline is not metaphysics but cognition of theory. He'll move beyond that when we get to the questionnaire on philosophy, which is something that he wrote for his Jesuit superiors. They sent him a whole load of questions. They sent these out to a lot of Jesuits, and I'm sure they never expected to get back what they got back from him, because it's a huge treatise that they probably didn't understand. But the basic discipline in there, the Grund- und Gesamtwissenschaft, and the goes to that German, is cognitional theory, epistemology, metaphysics, existential ethics. So it's basically, you might say, it's insight and method and theology together is the basic discipline. The relation to the other disciplines. With Aristotle, metaphysics was the basic discipline, and all the other disciplines were specifications of his metaphysical terms. So his psychology is still spoken of in the terms of potency, act, and so on and so forth. And so also with his ethics. So that was the older formulations of things, but rather the relationship between the transcendental method and the categorical determinations appropriate to specific enterprises. So all of these enterprises, whether it's physics or philosophy or theology or hermeneutics or literary criticism, they will all be the result of people being attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. But the categories will be arrived at differently in the different disciplines depending on the different questions that are being pursued. System. System is not the realization of a deductivist ideal where there's only one true system. System, rather, is to be regarded as, well, systems are successive expressions of an ever fuller understanding of the relevant data. So, and that comes out of, and then there's also a transcendental notion of system that results from the appropriation of one's own conscious and intentional operations. And then finally, theology. There's a new notion of theology here. not what people said for centuries that it was, the science of God and of all things in relation to God, but rather theology in its entirety is reflection on the significance and value of a religion within a culture, where a culture is conceived not normatively but empirically. And there are many different cultures. All right, so common origin number 24. The common origin of philosophy of God and the functional specialty systematics is religious experience. God's gift of love. So out of that there arises the question of God. Religious experience is, out of religious experience we are led to seek a knowledge of God. What we are in love with remains something that we have to find out. When we find it out in the context of a philosophy, there results a philosophy of God. When we find it out in the context of a functionally differentiated theology, there results systematics. So one and the same God has unknowingly been found and is differently being sought by both philosopher and theologian. This is very Vogelinian in the sense that the one God that entered into Israel as Savior is the same God that Plato and Aristotle are opened up to when they are drawn to love of the world transcendent good. Not a different God. Now, he's got this thing which is also in method and theology, but it's really, it is helpful, the different forms of the question of God. So the basic form of the question of God arises when one questions one's questioning. But there are questions for intelligence, for reflection, for deliberation, and then there's the religious question. So each of these gives rise to a form, a distinct form, of the question of God. If we reflect on our questions for intelligence, well, we are, when we ask what is this and what is that, we're seeking intelligibility. If we find it, the question arises, does not the intelligibility of the object presuppose an intelligent ground? Does not an intelligent ground for everything in the universe presuppose the existence of God? Excuse me. That's one form of the question of God. He's not answering it. It's just saying that's one form that it takes. If I find intelligibility, well, does this not possibly mean that there's an intelligent ground of all of them? Questions for reflection. We reach through judgment, we reach the virtually unconditioned, but not the formally unconditioned. It happens to be so. That means it's contingently true. Can everything be contingent? If everything's contingent, is not the whole universe ultimately absurd? Because we can't explain why it exists. So must there not exist some necessary being whose existence is unconditioned to account for the existence of the beings whose existence is conditioned? Another form of the question of God. If we reflect on our questions for deliberation, what should I do? Well, reflecting on that question is, what difference does it make if I find out what I should do? Is there any point in asking that question in the first place? Or are human beings the only ones that are concerned about what's moral, what's valuable, what's worthwhile? Or does the universe itself have a moral being as the ground of the universe? Are we just fools seeking authenticity in a totally absurd universe? That's the question of God as it really hits home. And then the religious question. Some have found that there exists an unrestricted being in love, a mystery of love and awe, a being grasped by ultimate concern, a happiness that has a determinate content but no intellectually apprehended object. Such people will ask, with whom are we in love? So four distinct questions, cumulative, belonging together, and so philosophy of God, which is those first three forms of the question, and systematics, which clearly results from the fourth, should not be isolated from each other. And the basic question is not the philosophic one, but the religious one. The philosophic forms require a philosophically differentiated culture, but the religious question is common to all people who have had any religious experience whatsoever. All right, I know we're right at 4 o'clock. So the common objective of the two ultimately is taken up in his final issue there of the notion of the person, that the two together lead to the emergence of a person. The strongest and best of the relationships between persons is love. And if this is the case, then religious experience and the emergence of personality go hand in hand. The real common goal of the philosophy of God and of systematics is the development of persons. And because the person is one, a whole, not just a set of parts, the study of what makes persons persons should not be carried on under different principles and in different parts of departments of the university. Okay, I've skipped a few things, but I don't think too much that's important. We can take a question or two, but if you're in a hurry, feel free to leave. What else? How are we doing?
There's no, I prefer to hear other questions.
Okay. All okay for now? Our stuff for next week is the Larkin Stewart lectures, I believe. Have I got that right? Look at my outline here. Yeah, A New Pastoral Theology, pages 221 to 98 in the same book, so moving right on from what we just did. The four lectures that he gave at Trinity College in 1973. A New Pastoral Theology, Variations of Fundamental Theology, Sacralization and Secularization, and The Scope of Renewal.
Yes. One question. When Lonergan is talking about the context that makes theology, he's trying to mediate theology into a context, into a culture. Does he take into consideration the possibility that culture, the concept of culture, be multiple, and that fragments of culture be identified?
I think definitely. I mean, he definitely is a cultural pluralist, if there ever was one.
Okay, so maybe with Colombia we can have a different theology than the one here in Canada.
Because your context, you're raising a different set of questions and answers. Context for him is an interweaving of sets of questions and answers. It's a limited interweaving of sets of questions and answers. Now, on the global scene, however, these will be... that's fine. On the global scene, these contexts are going to be in communication with each other. And so they'll constantly be... They'll constantly be shifting, because the Colombian context is not going to stay just indigenous to Colombia. It's going to be in contact with... I mean, you're going to bring back to Colombia things that are going to change that context, because you've been in another context. But you're also bringing to this context things that are out of yours, and so you're influencing what... You're bringing questions that we may not have thought of as acutely. But that, just by raising questions, you're changing the context, our context. So there's this communication among them. But you're going to have certain emphases and so on that will be different in your theology, because theology mediates between a culture and the role of a religion in that culture. So what is the role of religion in your culture? Well, it's not going to be dialectically opposed to the role of religion in Canada, but it's going to be different. Or maybe it is, because maybe it will be decomposed in the sense that you might come up with insights that we need to hear about here. In that sense, I mean, you might have something to teach us. I don't know. I mean, but you know what I'm getting at?
The
communication.
Yes.
Maybe you know better than I know what I'm getting at. Being tired at the end of a class.
Okay.
This is great. I like the dynamic. Is it okay the way it's
going? It doesn't seem like there's much air in here, though.